Okay, the first obligation of a discussant is brevity, so I've got basically four questions. One question for each panelist, and then a fourth question that is about Marxism and queer studies and how we're supposed to understand the relationship between them now. For Emma, I was intrigued by the way you return us to this question of what do we mean when we say materialism. This is an intriguing call for a reconvergence of feminism and queer studies by way of an emphasis on the morphological. I want to hear more about how you understand the relationship between historical materialism and what I take to be your materialism of the morphological. An emphasis on morphology could seem to imply an emphasis on immediacy and an inattention to mediation, which is one of the defining characteristics of a Marxist analytic. But then you talk about how a history of changing gender norms needs to be understood in relation to morphology, how this history seems to have to do with broader histories of empire, of equivalency. There's a lot going on here, so I'd like to hear more about how you understand the relationship between these two different kinds of materialism. Alan, in the longer version of this paper that I read earlier this week, I took you to be a little bit more optimistic about this question of citizenship than you came across as being in this particular paper. I have no optimism at all for the very compelling reasons that you point out about the category of citizenship giving us any critical leverage at all from an even Marxist, much less Marxist, point of view. But that suggests, maybe I'm full of it, but maybe that suggests a sort of, that I'm not thinking dialectically enough about this. Do you think there's any reason at all, maybe the answer to this question is obvious, is there any reason at all why we can still be optimistic from a Marxian viewpoint about citizenship and its historical capacity? And the question for Cinzia is, this is a powerful analysis of how we can begin to think about the problem of gender and how that operates at the level of time and how it might the temporality of gender could converge with the temporalities of capital. Can we think productively about this in relation to the competing, incompatible temporalities of capital that you highlight at one point? If production, circulation, and reproduction, as Marx points out, have distinct and incompatible and conflicting temporalities, does that mean that the temporal performance of gender operates differently at these different moments? Does that mean that the temporal performance of gender mystifies those contradictions? I have argued that as the late 19th century gives way to the early 20th century in the United States, that a certain white middle class performative norm of manhood tends to get displaced from operating at the moment of production to an operation at the moment of consumption. Performative middle-class masculinity seems much more defined at the level of marketing and commodification and leisure time as you enter the early 20th century than it did, say, in the middle 19th century. And then a sort of fourth question, and I'm just sort of selfishly using this as an opportunity because it's something that I've been thinking about a lot, and it's a hypothesis, and I want to know the answer, but I don't. All three of these papers, at some level, seem both to question and to take for granted that an opposition or loggerheads between Marxism and queer studies persists. I would want to propose that in the last 10 years or so, we have seen queer studies bearing witness over and over again to Marxism's continuing vitality and indeed contributing to that vitality. To the extent that Marxist intellectuals remain unaware of the way in which capital has become one of queer studies' most central interpretive horizons and the way in which Marxism has become one of its increasingly apparent touchstones in Eric Clark and Miranda Joseph and Jose Munoz in the 2005 special social text issue on queer studies in which the category of neoliberalism played a pretty prominent part. To the extent that Marxist intellectuals remain unaware of this, this is surely because in order to be aware of these developments, you would have to follow journals like GLQ, and special queer studies issues of social text and book series like NYU's sexual cultures. Just, you know, a quick laundry list. Dugan's New Homonormativity essay, I think is fair to say, is one of the most widely cited articles in queer studies in the last decade. There's the Queer Futures issue of Radical History Review. Munoz's Cruising Utopia, I think, is a huge moment. Even Adelman's No Future argument provokes an argument that is very deeply invested in a certain kind of Marxist theoretical tradition. If you're not aware of this, there's an issue of GLQ that I think is supposed to appear before this year is over, a special issue called Queer Studies and the Crises of Capitalism. I think that special issue is supposed to appear before 2011 is over. Aberrations in Black by Roderick Ferguson, as I think everyone is aware, has some hugely suggestive things to say about queer studies in the Marxist tradition, especially in the introduction. So, I want to suggest that at least the beginnings of a properly dialectical response to the ostensible opposition between Marxism and queer studies is to be found today in the very place where Marxist intellectuals are least likely to find it, within queer studies. So, to some extent, convergence and divergence both persist. I guess my big question is this. If there is some serious opposition or loggerheads between Marxism and queer studies that persists, to what extent is that opposition still operating at the level of ideas? And to what extent is this opposition at this point much more a question of academic marketing? Because presumably, if it's about academic marketing, that's something that Marxist intellectuals would want to have a critical account of. Thanks.